Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the NeoWinCast News Edition for February 9th, 2007. I'm your usual host, Chris Vendemio. You know me as BangBang023. And joining me, as he has been, Rob Wright. You know him as Rob on the forums. What's up, man?
It's all good. It's all good. How's things with you?
Well, if we get this damn show recorded without any more bugs, I'd be a very happy guy at this point.
Let's give it a shot.
Yeah. All right. So we're going to jump right into it. And we're going to pick up from where we left off two shows ago, discussing about DRM. Because, well, no one else can stop talking about it. Namely, this time, Steve Jobs and the RIAA are giving little pokes at each other. Steve Jobs started off with a little essay he wrote called Thoughts on Music. In the essay, he blames the RIAA for DRM, saying that they required Apple to have DRM, that without the DRM, iTunes or any of the digital music stores would never exist, because they don't trust what people would do with the open-ended files that aren't protected. I guess he has a point there. He also says that the reason Apple doesn't license Fair Play is because they have a limited time window to fix any breaks in the security system. So if someone cracks Fair Play, they have only a couple of weeks before each music's company has the right to pull all their music from the iTunes music store. He said if you had a bunch of people using Fair Play, a bunch of stores licensing the technology, if there was a break, it'd be much harder to fix within that allotted time. You know, Rob, what do you think about all this, man?
It's one of those things. I mean, this is just never-ending battle with, you know, consumers who, you know, DRM's a pain. It's a pain for me. I hate, you know, I have on iTunes, I'm in a shared house with some friends of mine, and it's great being able to kind of just see each other's iTunes music. But then if you want to play something that anyone's bought, then it just takes ages. You've got to activate the machine so that it allows you. I mean, it's just a hassle, isn't it? I mean, I can understand exactly what's going on in terms of the reasons behind digital rights management and also about some of the intricacies with, you know, the agreement that the big four companies have with, you know, Apple itself. But I don't know. I mean, this open letter, Steve was basically going on about how he realizes the importance of it, but wouldn't a society and wouldn't a culture be great where we wouldn't need it? And he's sort of almost challenging the music companies to allow him to do this. And it's quite an interesting letter because, I mean, it's full of rhetoric and it's all very kind of marketing speak, but actually it sort of highlights a sort of utopian it's a society where we wouldn't have to have, you know, the digital rights management, and people would be free to, you know, buy music that they wanted to and then put it on any player. I mean, that's the one thing that winds me up about the iTunes store, is that you can only use an iPod or iTunes to play that music. And clearly this is very bad for consumers.
It's just, I don't know, to me it seems like he won't admit any part of the blame, you know, he won't take any part of the blame for the DRM and how prevalent it's become, because let's face it, even he admits DRM can be very annoying, to say the least. And he seems to want to put all the blame on the RIAA. He even goes out as far as saying that Apple would adopt a DRM-free system immediately if the music companies would allow them to. Now, that's great and all, but when you look at the sales of the iPod, when you look at how intricate the iPod is to iTunes, you know, and vice versa, how basically they both help each other sell the product. Do you honestly think that Apple would be so quick to remove DRM and thus opening up their store to any player, opening up their device to play music from any store so quickly?
Well, I think it's important to note that Apple primarily is a hardware company. And this is what they've made their money on, and they make the bulk of their money from iPod sales. Now, because of the way that, you know, a lot of the music obviously goes to the recording artists and things like that, in terms of actually how much money they make from the iTunes store, I'm not quite sure. There was an interesting editorial written, and I'm just trying to remember where it is. That's really bad. I can't remember. But there was somebody who stated that actually the amount of money they make isn't so much that by opening it up, it would obviously increase, you know, the iPod's market share, because then it would increase the use of the iTunes store, because other players would be able to play it, and therefore actually it would sort of even out. So I think actually for Apple it probably would be very good. But then you've got to remember, of course, this is all just it's an open letter. If they're actually serious about it, then it wouldn't be open. It's a big, you know, marketing speech, and it's kind of made the media talk about it. But, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, one thing we should mention too is that, well, I think I did mention it earlier, the RIAA came back and they were a little underhanded with their jabs at him. They basically said, "We have no doubt that a technology company as sophisticated and smart as Apple could work with the music community to make that happen." He was talking about licensing Fair Play out to other online digital music stores. But, you know, Jobs went into his whole spiel about how we can't do that because then we can't fix any problems quick enough, yada, yada, yada. Who is this going to be a game, I should say, where they're just gonna, it's going to be a, like the Limp Bizkit song used to say, it's all about the he says, she says, bulls, you know, like that. Is this going to be one big back and forth battle where they're going to keep putting these open quotes out there to dig at each other?
Well, at the moment, it's just like a game of sort of political tennis, isn't it? I mean, we've got Apple at one side sort of saying, how, you know, look how wonderful our iTunes store is done, and actually, wouldn't it be great because we value our consumer? And, you know, they're of course, coming out with this whole thing because, you know, like the Mac versus PC things, they're doing all this big kind of, yeah, we understand consumers' needs. And that's great, but in terms of actually the way the industry is, I mean, if you look back, way back when music piracy first started, when we had the likes of the original Napster on the scene, that just made a completely revolution in music. And the whole issue of now buying digital music, that's actually becoming a viable solution. But it's still a pain in the ass for customers. So I don't know whether just, you know, Steve saying, well, wouldn't it be great if we could just get rid of DRM? It seems that that's more just a kind of marketing spiel than actually a proper solution.
One thing, too, that struck me was in the article about the RAAA response, they were getting some quotes from people, I guess, quote-unquote, in the industry. And two quotes stood out to me. One was from Phil Lee, I hope I'm saying his name right. He's a senior analyst at Inside Digital Media. And he said, digital music has entered the mainstream. The restrictions the labels require Apple and others to carry are preventing the market from developing to its full potential. It's retarding the growth. However, you had a guy, Doug Mitchelson, over from Deutsche Bank. I hope I said that right. He says, eliminating online DRM appears to us to be an overly risky move that eliminates the potential for a future digital-only distribution model free of piracy. You know, I can see both their points. I can see Doug's point where you need some kind of preventative measures in place to try to stop piracy. It may not be all that successful, but at least you try. At the same point, too, at least I know from my own personal standpoint, I don't buy digital media because of the fact that all the DRM on it, I really don't want to wind up losing it because something stupid happens where maybe I change operating systems or something like that and the DRM simply isn't supported there. Which one of these guys would you more agree with, Phil, or, you know, Phil who says it's retarding the growth, or Doug who says, well, we need it there and removing it would be way too risky?
I'm inclined to agree with Doug. I think that because of the nature of people, I mean, pretty much everyone loves music, and everyone has a particular artist that they love or a genre that they love, and music, it's like a collective experience. I mean, people like to share it with friends. And because of that, it's very difficult to make a business model out of sharing music and letting people share it. So I don't think by removing digital rights management, you're actually going to come up with a viable business solution. I mean, what we've got? We've got Universal, EMI, Sony, and Warner, who control like just about 70% of the market. They're the ones that are calling the shots here. And they have, at the moment, given absolutely no you know, indication that they're willing to come up with a non-DRM model. I mean, there was some, was it EMI that came up with some?
I was going to say EMI is actually debating right now. I think it's going to be limited to Europe for the meantime, but actually releasing a sizable portion of their library in the DRM-free MP3 format. They've done a few tracks here or there by, list here, Nora Jones, Lily Allen, and the band Reliant K. But they're also, you know, thinking about putting whole sections of the library, not just single songs, out there. And you know, that's obviously pretty big, in my opinion. If they actually go out there and do that, EMI spokeswoman Jean Meyer even says the feedback from fans has been very enthusiastic. And you know, I don't see why not. It definitely opens up the market a little more as far as consumer choice goes. Do you think that maybe DRM-free is going to really, sadly, rely on EMI's choice here, and if they choose to do it, the success of the program itself?
I mean, it takes one player to do it and to judge response, doesn't it? I mean, that's just the way business works. You've got to have one person with a vision and then, you know, just seeing the way it works. I don't know. I think it's going to be very interesting when we see the results of this. I know I read about it. I didn't realize that they were actually looking for significant portions of their back catalogue. But that's going to be interesting because right now, you know, like you, Chris, I don't buy music online because I like to be able to do with the music what I will. I will go into an HMV or Virgin Megastore or whatever, wonderful product placement there, and actually buy a CD because then I can rip it to my iPod, and then I know that I can listen to that. You know, I can listen to that music in the car. I can do what I want with it. And I think that is important. We've got to get rid of these restrictions, but also somehow come up with a business model that functions and people can actually make money out of this in a kind of ethical and moral way. And that's where we're going to have to see what happens with this EMI program. And yeah, it's going to be an interesting topic for a future podcast, I'm sure.
Yeah. One thing, too, I want to ask you, because I have my own views on it. The whole idea of DRM was to stop piracy. It all comes back to piracy, people stealing music. And recently, another issue that came up was the RIAA released a letter. I know I didn't put this in the show notes. I actually removed it, but sorry to spring this on you. But they was saying out how CDs are a great value, how at the $12.95 US that they're currently valued at, that's a great entertainment value, blah, 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 you know, all that. They're saying that if they went with the consumer index value, that it would be much higher, about $33 a CD. Yeah, right. But one thing I guess I have to ask is, what's going to stop piracy? Because, let's face it, DRM hasn't stopped piracy. Sony wound up getting sued themselves for trying to stop piracy with their little hidden software there. So, you know, what's the best way to attack piracy if now DRM is coming under attack itself, and it's not working anyway?
Well, there's been an interesting kind of look at these companies, and indeed nations, I think, that have looked at the idea of putting an extra taxation on discs, but then allowing legal peer-to-peer file sharing. Now, it seems incredibly radical, and it's something that is almost sort of, well, I mean, it's disturbing to even suggest, but when you actually look at it, I mean, I wonder whether it's even possible, because people, as I said before, you know, music is one of these collective experiences, and people like listening to it with friends, sharing what they love. And, you know, you don't want to have to sort of go, well, this is a great track, but, you know, you've got to pay for it first because I don't want to listen to it. And it just gets really silly, doesn't it? And you go and you can go around to a friend's house and you can put a CD in a CD player and listen to it and experience it. And that's what music's all about, I think. It's about an expression and it's about an enjoyment. So I think, you know, maybe it's kind of a bit of a disturbing thought. But if CDs were, I don't know, slightly more expensive, or maybe taxation on players, or I'm not quite sure how it would work. I mean, it's a big topic with a lot of breadth. But, you know, maybe if we got some kind of solution whereby the artist would still get paid, but people could still share music and could still experience music, and somehow, you know, it would be okay in a business world. It's a strange one, but it's been thought about and it's been discussed, and I just don't know whether, you know, as you said, DRM hasn't stopped piracy, and it hasn't stopped it at all, and piracy is still happening big style. So, I don't know. What do you think?
Now, see, I think what it comes down to is guaranteed quality of the works, because even I know that, I mean, I love a lot of rock bands. I'm usually pretty open-minded when it comes to the bands I enjoy. I'll forgive them for a bad track here or there, but let's face it, there's a lot of albums out there right now that have one, two, maybe three good tracks, and the rest of it's just filler to sell a bunch of singles. I think that's what hurts them more than anything, because people start to feel a little ripped off, I guess, because you're there, you spend your $12.95, whatever you're paying for a CD, you get it home and you realize, well, you could have gotten the same songs you like for $3 on iTunes, or you could just download the three songs for free because, well, you would just save yourself a lot of hassle and a lot of money. I think quality is an issue. The whole idea of marketing music has changed a lot in recent, I guess, since I've been following it. It's all about the singles now. That's all it's about. It's almost to a point where it seems as though the record companies don't care about the other tracks on the CD. It's just those few songs that they're going to get played on the radio that really matter to them. And the rest, whatever. Whatever happens, happens. That kind of bothers me. I think if they improve quality, fans knew ahead of time exactly what they were getting, if they could expect good things, maybe they'd be a little less willing to steal. But when it comes down to it, you know, you got to give people a reason not to steal. That's how I feel. If it's good enough, if they feel it's good enough and worth the money, then they'll pay for it. That's the way it works in the world. That people are willing to pay for what they think. There's always going to be people stealing, don't get me wrong, but level-headed, nice, good people are going to be willing to pay for good music. I guess that's my own opinion.
No, that's absolutely true, because you get sort of, real big fans of bands would not even dream of stealing their music, and because that's the way it works.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, my favorite band is Stained, not Sting, like some people always think I say.
but you know, I would the Police there, Chris.
Yeah, no, not a big fan of the Police. Yeah, the Puff Daddy remix was okay, but other than that, no. but yeah, I mean, I can never dream of not paying for their CDs because I like their music. I expect to get quality every time, and I'm okay with that. But you know, when I'm jumping out there, maybe some of the smaller bands that I don't always follow, something like Disturbed or back in the day before Issues came up with the band Drowning Pool, you know, I wasn't always sure what I was going to get. So I would rather them work on those issues instead of just saying, let's put crappy music out there, we'll just protect it to make it harder for people to steal, even though they're going to steal it anyway. But, you know, I'm not in their heads, unfortunately. I can't hit them where appropriate. But I'm getting tired of talking about DRM, because there's like 2.5 shows now we've done on DRM, and it's old news. How about we move forward, man?
I think that's a good idea. Let's talk about some games, shall we?
Yeah, let's get into the gaming. We're actually going to step on Todd's territory. I should mention that Todd's not here because of some technical issues with his microphone, on top of all the technical issues we've had getting this damn show on the air. But Blizzard, the makers of World of Warcraft, a huge, huge hit. Well, this is an interesting quote. In 5 years, maybe you won't need a console anymore. They're talking about console video games such as PlayStation 3, Xbox 360, Nintendo Wii. Who is this guy? I'm trying to figure out this guy's name right. His last name is Bassett. He's vice president of business development. I can't even think of how to pronounce
it. Itzik
Bassett, maybe? Yeah. Anyway, this guy says, the PC is becoming an entertainment hub. You use it to watch videos and TV, play games, listen to music. With wireless, you can send your content from your PC to anywhere in the house, to your TV, something I already do. You can play PC on your TV because it's an LCD screen. Consoles are becoming sophisticated PCs which sit in the living room. We'll have to see how all this develops. Maybe in 5 years you won't need a console because you'll have one PC which delivers content all over your house. So, do you agree with me or disagree that this guy is smoking some really good stuff?
I don't know. I think, yeah, it's a bit far-fetched. Because I think, well, you know, I've got... You can look at, I don't know, mobile phones or whatever. You know, you've got a camera built into a mobile phone, but it's not the greatest quality ever. And people like having one thing that does it very well. You know, and those hardcore gamers that will be looking at the next release and the greatest and the best. I think, you know, having just one PC that streams everything and you can play it on, it's a nice kind of ideal, and it works very well in the whole Microsoft sort of digital memories thing, and you know, having things always there for you. But I just don't know quite how it works in the real world.
Yeah, my issue is, I actually have two issues. I'll start with one of them. First of all, we can't even get media center PCs to permeate the living room yet. I mean, they're very, very rare as far as how people are getting their entertainment in their living room. And the fact is, they're not as seamless as this guy would make us think. Right now, I think there's one device that just got released in the market that allows you to use cable cards to get your premium cable channels if you subscribe to them. You know, other than that, you can't even get premium cable channels in your PC right now. Never mind getting rid of your console to play all your video games. It seems as though if he wants a PC that's going to become one giant entertainment hub, they have to work on the basics first, like getting TV into the living room hassle-free, where we can get the same functionality I get on my current cable box or satellite box in some cases, that I do now, and put that onto the computer. Because until that happens, I don't think anyone wants to fiddle around with a computer, lose channels in the process, and spend more money just for what it really is right now, a cool factor.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like you're paying just for the fun of integrating it, but actually it doesn't work that well. I mean, media centers, PCs, they're a great vision, and when you get them just working fine, it can be pretty cool. But as you say, there's so many things that, well, you can't do that, so you've got to rip the SCART out and put it in another box, and then you've got to move that across because you wanted to. It just doesn't work. Now, he does say in 5 years. Now, 5 years is a great deal of time when it comes to computing.
Five years is a Windows operating system, my friend.
Exactly. We've got Vista Release 2 by then. Yeah, so I don't know. Like, you say, what's he smoking? But 5 years, I mean, who knows what's going to happen?
Yeah, but my other issue is too, is especially with computer PC games, it seems as though every PC game that comes out, you have to go buy some more damn hardware to support it because what you have is generally not enough for it. With the console, you're guaranteed, any games coming out that say works on this system, the system is going to play it fine. Maybe there's not huge leaps and bounds in as far as the games themselves go from beginning to end as there could be on the PC. But at the same point too, there's no hassle. There's no worry. Well, do I have the right drivers installed? Do I have a fast enough video card? Is my RAM up to speed with everything? Don't you think that PC gaming, if it wants to become the mainstream, where it's the only gaming, they need to make it more convenient and less about pushing the hardware as far as you can and forcing people to upgrade?
Yeah, for sure. One of the things that's always been great about consoles is the fact that, it's truly, you just plug it in and you can play any game that's released for it. And that's awesome. I mean, I grew up on DOS, I grew up on boot disks and
Oh
having
God,
to,
yeah.
yeah, exactly. And, editing auto exec to get something to work. And it's hell, it really is. And of course, Windows changed that a little bit and things were a little bit easier. But you've still got the fact that every new game that's released will require the latest and greatest because that's the way innovation works. But not every PC has the latest and greatest. Therefore, you're forcing consumers to upgrade their RAM, to upgrade their video cards, to upgrade their processor, and actually, when it comes to DirectX 10, to upgrade their entire operating system
Yeah, I mean,
just for the sake of one game.
and you look at issues right now where, for instance, I have Vista installed, and well, my NVIDIA drivers, well, they're pretty crappy. And yeah, I can't really play. I can't pleasantly play games because my frame rate is a good half of what it used to be on XP. So, that's not what you want to. That's not what you want. There are people who don't want to have to deal with that. I mean, right now, I'm thinking about getting a 360. I've been saying this for months now, but I'm gonna get it and. Now, I always go back to console gaming because in the end, when I want to get away from the PC, when I don't want to worry about updating this driver, downloading this, tweaking that, I can just pop my disc in to the console, play for an hour, and I'm done. No hassle. I really think that's what they need to focus on more than I think any other advancements in gaming right now is convincing these companies, especially guys over at companies like id, who basically make games to make your hardware seem like it's worthless, convince them that, hey, work with what's out there right now, work with the mainstream. Then again, what determines the mainstream, you know what I'm saying? Because I have a 6600 GT doesn't mean everyone has a 6600 GT. Maybe there's a lot more 7900s out there. Maybe there's a lot of 6150s out there. No one really knows. I don't know. It just, to me, it seems like a pipe dream right now. I think even though 5 years in computers is a very long time, there is no way in hell the PC in 5 years is going to overtake console gaming. That is, unless the consoles screw themselves by throwing prices through the roof to the point where it becomes cheaper to game on the PC. But other than that, yeah, I just don't see it. I mean, I don't know what else to say on it. I think this guy is wrong.
Yeah, I know, I completely understand what you're saying. It would take an entire paradigm shift in the way that gaming is done on PCs to make this ever happen. But then, it takes people like him to have a dream about it. But I do think 5 years is a little bit too short.
Yeah, but this isn't Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream here. This is, I
Yeah,
can't
but it's
pronounce his
people. It's Itzik.
Idzik,
Itzik Bassett. No, but people like him have to say, hey, this is what I want. But I agree, 5 years is not going to happen. But 5 years, maybe you'll see the start of a kind of standardization in terms of the way that gaming's done. Who knows? We'll see.
And then Microsoft will release the next operating system and we'll all be
And it will
screwed again.
screw it all over, yeah.
All right, and we're gonna continue the gaming trend right now. Okay, well, we're gonna take a trip through to Japan, boys and girls, because in Japan, where they're, well, basically, let's just start off by saying the 360, they couldn't give it away for free right now in Japan, but to homegrown companies, Nintendo and Sony with their PlayStation 3 are kind of battling it out because right now the Wii is outselling the PS3 almost 3-to-1, which is, well, that's a large number. According to the publisher, Nintendo sold around 405,000 Wii units last month, compared with around 148,000 units of the PS3. He goes on to say they reckon the figures are this way because there's a wider range of games for the Wii, and the PS3's higher price tag is hindering sales. Well, yeah, pretty much. I think the guy put it spot on. when you look at the PS3, there's no good. I mean, Resistance, I heard, is good, but other than that, what is out there for the PS3 to warrant spending $500, $600 on a system when you can go spend $250 for a system, I'm speaking in US dollars, of course, and get a fun experience? Does it shock you at all, though, that the Wii is dominating the PS3 that much in Sony's, you know, I guess it's Nintendo's territory too, but on Sony's turf in Japan?
It's a big ratio, isn't it? 3-1.
That's large,
yeah. Yeah, I don't think I expected it quite that stage. I mean, I do think that the PS3 is ridiculously expensive, and as you know, as we've said, that the Wii has a lot more games for it. But at 3-1, that's huge. I mean, do we have any figures for the US or in Europe?
No, I don't have any numbers on me right now, and well, looking them up would probably get me into a fanboy flame war, so I don't want to risk that.
That's fair, I think. But no, I don't know, that's a big ratio. I think I'd be interested in reading some sort of analyst's point of view on that, but I think what has been said about it just being too expensive and it not having enough games, then maybe the state of play is going to change pretty soon. Maybe when the PS3 matures a little bit more and we start getting kind of greater market share, then you know maybe that's going to happen. But wow, 3-1.
Yeah, it's definitely a little... I'm not surprised it's beating the PS3, but I'm definitely surprised by that much. One issue that always sticks out in my mind, though, is in Japan, the gamers are a lot more willing to experiment with new styles of gameplay. The DS is very, very strong proof of that, and obviously the Wii is now, too. So when I saw the US gamers taking to the Wii like they did, it almost... Well, if we're doing this, can you imagine what the crazy people over in Japan are going to do for the Wii? You know, because they're a lot more open-minded when it comes to gaming. And I guess I underestimated them even that far, because 3-1 is huge. And it all comes back to the Wii is a very unique gaming system. It's by far not the most powerful, but it's definitely the most unique. And it comes back to, well, what is the PS3 offering me besides one good game and a very, very large... bill. Your credit card bill is going to eventually come in for that, and you're going to be going, man, maybe I shouldn't have gone for that system. You know, it's a shame. I think software is an issue with them. They need to get better games out there. However, in the same breath, developers are saying they don't want to release games for a system that has so few units actually sold. So there's a very small potential customer base there. So this is sort of a situation where which came first, the chicken or the egg, you know. What's going to come first, more consoles sold or more software created, when they're both sort of interdependent on each other? What do you think is going to happen?
I don't really know. I'm not a huge gamer, and I look at this very much from a kind of completely objective point of view, because I'm not a console player, and the games that I end up playing on the PC are those that I've enjoyed for the last 5 years, because this is just the way that I work. I use my PC for work, and this is what I do. But I don't know. It's one of those things that, as you say, the Wii is very unique, and I think the uniqueness of it has actually has made it quite a success. And it needed that uniqueness, and it wasn't just a kind of incremental. Like we've had the PlayStation, PlayStation 2, PlayStation 3. Wii was very different, and I think to their credit, you know, that's been one of the saving graces of it. It's managed to kind of gain a huge amount of market share, and as we see from the figures. You know, even just insane amounts in Japan. So I don't know, what do you see as going to happen within the next 6 months? I mean, where do you see this?
In the 6 months, it's hard to say. I think, you know, I'm not well versed on what games are coming for the PS3, so I can't sit here and say, well, this game will do it exactly. But I think it's going to come down to a point where they're going to need a killer software app out before the consoles will sell. Some developers are going to have to bite the bullet and say, this game is going to sell consoles, we're sure of that. Here it is, you know, a game like Final Fantasy, Metal Gear Solid. They're even talking about Killzone 2, which is supposed to be pretty big. Sony's still believing that eventually the Killzone franchise can overwhelm the Halo franchise. I think they're smoking the same stuff the other guy from Blizzard is smoking, but you know, eventually it's going to, I think one developer is going to have to put a killer app out there and say, here it is, now go buy your consoles, and that'll get the numbers up there. Sony dropping the price, that could help too, but considering they're losing about $300 per console, I'm not sure they can afford to drop the price anymore. You know, you'd have to drop it a good $100 to really get people looking in a direction more intently, I guess you could say. So yeah, it's definitely going to be interesting. I laugh. I enjoy Sony's misery. But you know, it's definitely a tough time. It's definitely a tough time for the company. They're going to have to get creative. Maybe stop spending all this money on some really retarded, sorry if that offends anyone, commercials for the PS3, you know, baby dolls making stuff float. I really don't care. That doesn't advertise the PS3 at all. But other than that, yeah, I mean, it's got to be that killer app. But yeah, we'll finish up the show, though. We're going to move away from the gaming, get back to our homeroom roots. Last week we talked about Vista, and well, Vista's been out for a week now, so we can just start talking about the sales a bit. And it seems as though Home Premium, by a very large margin, the top-selling version of Vista right now in the consumer market.
We rock. This is what we tell people.
Yeah, exactly. I'm pretty sure after they heard our show, they all ran out and said, I want Home Premium because Chris and Rob told me to get it. But, let me just read through this article fast. Shows that sales of PCs with Vista Home Premium pre-installed comprise 70% of PC unit sales in the U.S. retail market, while sales of PCs with Vista Home Basic accounted for 22%. Vista Ultimate accounted for a wonderful 1.2% of the sales. Now, you have to realize this is pre-installed, so these are people buying new computers, too. These aren't retail copies of the software only, so that's something to take into account. However, either way, it's pretty obvious that, at least I know where I work, a large big box electronics store, their main focus is on Home Premium. And, well, it seems people are at least taking, if not our advice, the advice of logical people out there and going for the
really, really, it is our advice.
Yeah, I mean, I'll take credit for it. I have no problem. It makes us sound really, really credible. But
we're industry analysts now, Chris.
I think that's a tag we could slap on anytime we wanted, because that's what people seem to do. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely interesting to see. 70%, that's a large portion of the number of sales. But what shocked me, though, is how poor the sales of Windows Ultimate, Vista Ultimate were. 1.2%, that's kind of low end, don't you think?
It's tiny. I was expecting more. I mean, Microsoft have kind of touted all these Vista Ultimate extras and all the rest of it that's supposedly going to help. But I don't know. I always felt that when I'd seen the advertisements, that Ultimate really was being advertised as, you know, the complete right at the high end. And it's almost like their marketing campaign has almost backfired on them, and that they haven't managed to get the kind of market share, the share of the sales, should I say. That they've actually managed to get 70% for Home Premium, but then 70% the Home Premium is what's right for about 70%. It's almost like people are actually buying the version that really is right for them, and I'm quite shocked that they are. I think I had a bit of a what's the word? I think I thought that people would actually go for the Ultimate just because you know people like to go, well, you know, this is only so much extra, and well, it might give me a lot. And if you're buying something like a new PC, it's a pretty major purchase. So it's almost like you would go for something that's a bit better. Now we've got a guy called Samir Bhavnani, who is from the Current Analysis Research, and he has basically said that he thinks that this was going to change, and that over time it's going, you know, Ultimate's going to be a bit bigger part of the mix. What do you think? Do you think that it's actually going to increase?
I think Microsoft is going to have to come to a point where they either say Ultimate's not going to be what we expected it to be, or we're going to have to go piss off the people who bought Premium and start putting a lot of exclusives for the Ultimate install base out there, which would take me off. I know they have exclusive games right now, such as Texas Hold'em and stuff like that. Not really that big of a deal to me.
Oh, it's impressive. Texas Hold'em right there.
Yeah. But, you know, if they start maybe giving all their attention to Ultimate instead of shunning the other versions, I can see people getting upset. So they have to handle this very, very carefully, where they don't leave the other people left out in the cold, feeling like, well, maybe they spent their money poorly. And don't give me that Windows Anytime upgrade nonsense, because I'm not a big fan of that either. I mean, it's a nice, convenient feature to have, but it's not as good as a clean install. So, yeah, I mean, it's going to be tough. I think. I mean, I'm not sure how many people are going to buy PCs with Ultimate pre-installed for the simple fact that OEMs are going to be want to cut the cost of their system, so they're going to put Home Premium on most of them, and that's what people are going to buy. So I think if Ultimate's going to succeed, it's going to come down to the people going out and buying the software themselves. But that comes back to a $400 price tag, which is it's beefy, to say the least. You know, that's a whole Xbox 360 right there. So it better be one heck of a Ultimate Edition, maybe Bill Gates' signature on it, hint, hint. But, you know, I don't know. It's going to be fun to follow. It's probably going to get a little pathetic at times, I think, as far as the numbers dipping. Do you ever see yourself using Ultimate Edition?
Not if I was buying it. I've done some stuff with the beta testing, and you know, that's why I've got the copy of Ultimate. But certainly, if I was building a new machine, or if I was recommending anything to friends, there's no way I would recommend Ultimate because it's just too expensive for what it gives. Now, as you say, we're going to have to see what happens with all these Ultimate extras. Now, maybe Microsoft are going to pull a big cat out of the bag, and we're actually going to find out that there's going to be something amazing that they're going to release only for Ultimate. And I think it's fair that they do. But as you say, it's a very sensitive situation because we've got all these people that are on the other versions of Windows, which are just as important to Microsoft. And so, you know, really hacking them off is not going to help the reputation of Microsoft at all. So it's going to be really interesting to see how they play this one.
This is why they should have had two versions, just like Home and Professional and XP.
Yes.
That's a whole other bitch fest right there. I hope I'm allowed to say bitch on the show.
To be fair, it's never stopped me swearing on this.
Yeah, but I think that's pretty much about it as far as the topics go. But Rob, we have to do our blanks of the week, so I'll let you start with your code of the week, since I don't know what the hell I'm going to pick for song of the week.
That's poor preparation, Chris. I'm not even
No,
right, code of the week. Let's see. Now, what I thought about is I talked just a little bit about header tags. So we have H1, H2, H3, H4, H5, and H6. And these are a way of putting your content in a kind of hierarchical fashion so that you can explain to users that this is a title here, this is a header here, and this is a subheader. And we've reached a stage now that because people just got people putting images for headers because they like a particular font, and that's great because design is very important when it comes to the web. That, you know, it's obviously data driven, but at the same time, design's important. But one of the things I would recommend people using is to use header tags, but then within the header tags, you can put, for example, your you can put an image in there, or just make sure that you have header tags even if you decide to not display them. You can set them to invisible, that's fine. But having header tags there is great for your search engine position because it means that people can actually, the content is a little bit more defined in terms of what it is. So it's really good for that, and also for those that don't have style sheets enabled, for example, you'll get a nice a nice header tag, and your content will look like it's actually structured properly. So I'd say, yeah, look at headers, don't give up on them just because the default styling is rubbish. You know, persist with them even if you choose not to use them and to just hide them. Put them in because they're really good.
Well, thank you. I've had some recent experience with headers working on my site, and I can say I hate them with a passion. Well, I hate CSS as a whole, but that's a whole other... I grew up on HTML 4. Whatever, so I'm still...
I've got to bite my tongue here.
Yeah, please do. Don't yell at me. But as for my song of the week, it's a smaller band out there, Smile Empty Soul. They had some big hits a few years ago, but record company issues sort of pushed them underground again. And the song I'm going to recommend is Out to Sea. It's the first song off their latest album, which was released on an independent label. I think it's a great album. It's called Vultures. If you have the money to pick it up, just spend the $12.95 as the RIAA wants you to pay. You know, go out and pick it up. But for now, listen to the song Smile Empty Soul, Out to Sea. Other than that, Rob, I think we're done, unless you have anything else to add quickly.
No, I think we've reached an excellent time index there, and it's time to say goodbye.
Saying goodbye is so hard, but then again, we'll be back next week. I'll be screwing up as usual. Rob will be here with his very cool accent to make me sound even dumber. But yes, we'll be back next week, boys and girls. Until then,
take care of yourself. Bye-bye.